to hide so that you carry it together. What a miracle. So that friend and I carry some things for one another. She knows some of the more painful, shameful parts of my story. I know some of hers. In our little tribe, we carry depression and addiction. We carry parents who drink and kids who struggle. We carry abortions and divorces and drug-using loved ones, ones who used to use, who still do, who we've lost because of it. We carry eating disorders and suicide. One night, one friend whispers into the circle, "I don't believe in God anymore." And we carry that because that's what friendship is. That's what it does. This little tribe may look squeaky clean, maybe like the kind of people who have no problems, like the kind of people who've only ever been swimming in the shallow end. But no one only lives in the shallow end. Life upends us all. And there's no sparkly exterior that can defend against disease and loss and cheating spouses. We carry depression and wounds and broken marriages. We carry addictions and diseases and scars and loss of faith. We carry it. Because that's what love is. That's what friendship is. So I'll walk into her party and I'll hug her tightly. And as I do, I'll say a prayer for her dad. I'll hug him too. And maybe he'll be high or maybe not this time. With him, to be honest, I can't always tell. And if you walked by the party, you might think, I'm not like them. I have secrets and problems and family members who embarrass me. I'm afraid. And our secrets are the bad kind. You'll see children running around and happy parents and you'll think you're not like them. But that's because you're not seeing what they carry. I see it, though, because they're my people. I see each of us who are carrying those heavy weights together for one another, on behalf of one another. And it's the most beautiful thing I can think of. We're all so much more similar than we are different. Our secrets are largely the same. Our fears are largely the same. Marriages crack. Addictions take hold. Families break. Decisions are made that can never be reversed. No one is exempt. My friend isn't alone. She won't be the only one at that party hoping that someone she loves pulls it together for a couple hours. She won't be the only one wishing her story was different, neater, simpler. At some point in the party, I'll check in with another old friend. I've been carrying his family's deception and betrayal and disease for decades. I'm honored to. And he carries the broken parts of my family's story and my failures and regrets. Because that's what we do. We carry the mess together. Your mess is mine. The narrowing. Last night, we took the boys to a new park adjacent to a t-ball game. Dads yelling from the stands, kids running in circles. We wound through a new neighborhood to get there, feeling a million miles from home. Earlier, I made curry for dinner. I wanted to try a jar of red Thai curry paste that I'd just bought. So in the afternoon when I should have been working, I made a relentlessly spicy shrimp and lentil curry, then a much sweeter one with chicken and broccoli and carrots, heavier on the coconut milk, lighter on the curry paste. We ate curry over brown rice and big bowls of watermelon. Then we ran around the park, discovering the trails and swings and slides. And then the boys played with Legos while I put away dinner and got the house ready for bed. One of my favorite routines, drapes pulled closed, water glasses on nightstands, required stuffed animals in each bed. I had just washed the sheets, so I went from room to room, putting pillows into fresh cases, smoothing sheets onto beds, pulling blankets over them, listening to the boys giggle and build. Just before bedtime, Aaron and Henry went for a walk around the neighborhood, big kid privilege. And I read a novel set in Italy, listening to Mac talk himself to sleep, watching the sun slide and fade. This morning I drank coffee and chatted with Aaron as he washed Mac's hair in the tub. There is nothing in all the world more attractive than a man who is tender with his small son, who washes his hair and gently wipes the water out of his blue eyes. Once the kids were dressed and breakfasts were eaten, we settled on the patio, as is our new custom, and the neighborhood kids came over to shoot baskets and ride bikes before the bus came. They yelped and played, asked us to watch them shoot over and over. As I watched them play, I was struck by how much has changed in the last 3 years. I thought that the speed, that frantic, anxious, powerful freight train, was outside of me, and that I needed to distance myself from it. That was partly true. But truer is that it's also inside of me. The roar of pressure and pushing and relentless motion. I've always been outrunning something. From my earliest memories, escaping into something, a story or a city or a meal or an experience, frantic, frenetic, a hummingbird, a bouncing ball. The journey of these years have been toward quiet, toward creating quiet around me, but more than that, toward creating quiet within me. which is much more difficult and much more profound. I'm amazed at how many things are ultimately connected. I like living in our home when it's less full of stuff. I find it easier to get dressed in the morning when I have fewer choices. I've been wandering through our house, gathering things up, less, 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 and in my closet, less, less, less. I'm creating quiet in our home, on our walls, in my own closet, and that quiet gave me energy. The simplicity feels spacious and inspiring, like I can draw a clean breath. I'm beginning to learn a new, slower speed, and I can feel my heartbeat elevate in a stressful way when I feel that old speed kicking up. I can do it. I'll always be able to do it, I suppose. But I don't want to anymore. The part of me that craved that breakneck way of living is also the part of me that was scared, that wanted to hide, that was always outrunning. I'm learning to silence the noise around me and within me and let myself be seen and loved, not for what I produce, but for the fact that I've been created by the hands of a holy God like every other thing on this earth, equally loved, equally seen. It seems to me that some people got the hang of this early in life, that they're just deeply fine and don't have to push or prove or earn or outrun. These people, I'm finding, are unicorns, rare and lucky. Most of us are trying to fill a wound, trying to outrun something, turning up the volume to drown out a song that's been haunting us all our lives. Good fruit. You don't have to sacrifice your spirit, your joy, your soul, your family, your marriage on the altar of ministry. Just because you have the capacity to do something doesn't mean you have to do it. Management, organization, speaking and traveling, you must ask not only what fruit they bring to the world, but what fruit they yield on the inside of your life and your heart. I didn't want to admit it, but I was surprised to find a holdout of that terrible old doctrine. If it hurts just awful, it must be God's will for you. And the other side of the same coin, if it produces fruit, it must be God's will for you. As I laid out those ideas, peered at them and through them, held them up to the light of God's word, I saw that they were half true at best, possibly less. First, we focus so often on the fruit for other people. It worked. People liked it. People gave me great feedback, and on and on. I've spent all my life surrounded by pastors and their families, and I've seen 1,000 examples of fruit in their churches and starvation in their marriages and families. I would not call that blessed or whole or healthy or God's intent. Our family's not perfect, but I grew up with a dad who communicated to me in no uncertain terms that our family life mattered immensely, that I mattered to him, that the time we spent together was sacred time. I can't thank him enough for that. In recent years, one reason I chose to write instead of working at our church is because I knew my own capacity to throw myself headlong into the immense and ongoing needs of the church at the expense of my family. I saw too many of my peers doing it, and I knew I'd be just as vulnerable as they are, maybe more so, to the seduction of public fruit and private wreckage. But one year I took 40 work trips. Who's to say that my family wouldn't have preferred me to be at the church, home in the evenings at least, as opposed to all those nights in hotels and airports? When we speak of regrets, this is my greatest one. That I allowed other people's visions for my career and calling take me away from what I know in my heart was the best, most whole way to live. It's an honor to be invited into those churches and conferences and colleges and bookstores, and I said yes and yes and yes because I wanted to help. Because I was honored to be asked, because of that warped idea that if there's fruit, it must be God's will. That faux theology very quickly degenerates into basic supply and demand. Your calling is not defined only by the fruit it provides to the kingdom. Another way to say it, your family and your very self are included in the kingdom you wish to serve. And if they are not thriving, the whole of your ministry is not thriving. Our family fared reasonably well during this season. Our boys were small, and my husband is an extraordinary parent, and we're so very thankful for 4 loving, present, connected grandparents and aunts and uncles who care so well for our boys. I, however, did not fare so well. I was wound up like a bottle rocket, sleeping poorly, eating terribly, prone to weird sicknesses and pains, vertigo for one. I threw up whenever I was stressed out, frequently in airports and parking lots, and yet I kept going because I had learned long ago that one's body is a perfectly acceptable offering on the altar of ministry. It did not occur to me that stress barfs are a warning sign. I knew better than to let our family suffer. My regret, though, and it is sizable and tender, is that I let myself suffer and deteriorate body and soul, and it's naive to think that didn't have profoundly negative effects on my children and my husband. I know it did. I cared for all three of them the best I could, but the person I was dragging back to our home week after week was a poor substitute for the wife and mother I wanted to be. I was not well, but I was very, very productive, and it didn't occur to me to stop. In a thousand ways, you live by the sword and you die by the sword. When you allow other people to determine your best choices, when you allow yourself to be carried along by what other people think your life should be, could be, must be, when you hand them the pen and tell them to write your story, you don't get the pen back. Not easily, anyway. I was an author who didn't know how to author her own life. I thought that outside forces would guide me benevolently, rightly. They did not, and it was not their job. It was mine. I abdicated authority for my own choices, and what it led to was a broken body and a depleted soul. And now, some years later, I know that I'm responsible for stewarding my own life, my desires and limitations, my capacities and longings. I can do far less than I originally believed, and I'm reveling in the smallness of my capacity. This is it. This is who I am. This is all I have to give you. It's not a fire hose, unending gallons of water knocking you over with force. It's a stream. Tiny, clear, cool. That's what I have to give. And that small stream is mine to nurture, to tend, to offer first to the people I love most, my first honor and responsibility. The twin undercurrents of being a woman and being a Christian is sort of a setup for getting off track with this stuff. Women are raised to give and give and give, to pour themselves out indiscriminately and tirelessly. And Christians, or some anyway, are raised to ignore their own bodies, their own pain, their own screaming souls, on behalf of the other, the kingdom, the church. It has been tremendously helpful to think of myself as a part of the kingdom, a part of the church. I'm not building the kingdom if that work is destroying this member of that kingdom. If you burn down your garden in order to make more room to host and feed your friends, you would find yourself short-sighted the next time you wanted to feed those people you loved, right? I set myself aflame as often as necessary, whatever it took to keep going, to build, to help. But I'm learning slowly that wholeness prevails. As I sit now, the sound of the waves and the boat engines in the distance, the fishermen drifting by the peninsula, the flaking paint, and the Adirondack chair on which I sit, I hardly recognize the woman I was for those years, and I breathe a prayer of gratitude for this new way of living. I've been saved. And I feel all the vigor of a zealot, a recent convert. This is what I'm finding every day, every hour. There is a way of living that is so sweet, so full, so whole and beautiful, you'll never want to go back once you've tasted it. Do you know what it's like to be rested, truly rested? I didn't for about 2 decades. Do you know what it's like to feel connected in deep and lovely ways to the people you love most? Do you know the sweetness of working hard and then stopping the working hard, realizing that your body and your spirit have carried you far enough and now they need to be tended to? I feel like a newborn in all this, blissful and delighted each time I take care of myself, like a new skill or a present. What I'm leaving behind doesn't leave me empty. It leaves me full, powerful, purposed, and stronger than I've ever been. I'm not building a castle or a monument. I'm building a soul and a family. I'll tell stories all my life, writing on napkins and on the backs of receipts or in books if they let me, but this is the promise I make to my God. I will never again be so careless, so cavalier with the body and the soul you've given me. They are the only things in all the world that have been entrusted entirely to me, and I stewarded them poorly, worshiping for a time at the altars of productivity, capability, busyness, distraction. This body and soul will become again what God intended them to be, living sacrifices offered only to Him. I will spend my life on meaning, on connection, on love, on freedom. I will not waste one more day trapped in comparison, competition, proving, and earning. That's the currency of a culture that has nothing to offer me. It is not too strong to say that on this summer morning, sitting in a fire pit on a peninsula on Lake Geneva, I'm offering myself and the whole of my life once again to Jesus. And in that, I'm leaving behind both my tangle with achievement and workaholism and my neglect of my body and spirit. I'm offering to Jesus a mind, a body, a spirit, a life, a voice, a table. Here's the distinction. It is for him. It is not for all Christian events and publishers and causes. It's not for the building of my brand, a term I abhor, or the wider Christian brand, another term I abhor. It is for Jesus. More important, it is with Jesus. I gave myself away indiscriminately. Be careful how much of yourself you give away, even with the best of intentions. There are things you cannot get back, things that God has not asked you to sacrifice. At the end of your life, I believe you will account for what you gave yourself to. Be very careful that you're not giving yourself to a pale imitation of life with Christ, life about Christ, or life generally near to Christ. I live in the very belly of the beast, the breakneck, competitive suburbs of Chicago where everyone's building something, part of a church I adore, but definitely errs on the fast-paced side of things, part of a family that regularly runs itself ragged, and then runs itself ragged on vacation, the quintessential work hard, play hard family. But I'm out of that game because I came too close to losing the only thing I really have, myself. I believed I was invincible, that my body would listen to my mind if I was forceful enough with it, believed that I wasn't one of those delicate flower ladies who had to drench herself in silence and green juice in order to function. Black coffee, red eyes, old school, old guard, with enough coffee and eyeliner I could stand on any stage. But I did throw up more than is probably normal. I cried hot tears in the car or in the shower. I administrated my children more than I did snuggle and listen to them because snuggling and listening required emotional resources I'd long since depleted. Part of the crazy of it is that we don't allow people to fall apart unless they're massively successful. You can't just be a normal lady with a normal job and burn yourself out. That's only for big shot people. And so the normal, exhausted, soul-starved people keep going because we're not special enough to burn out. Burnout is not reserved for the rich or the famous or the profoundly successful. It's happening to so many of us, people across all kinds of careers and lifestyles. If you're tired, you're tired no matter what. If the life you've crafted for yourself is too heavy, it's too heavy, no matter if the people on either side of you are carrying more or less. You don't have to have a public life or a particularly busy life in order to be terribly, dangerously depleted. You just have to buy into the idea that your feelings and body and spirit aren't worth listening to and believe the myth that busyness or achievement or both will take away the pain. And you can buy into those things as a stay-at-home parent or a brain surgeon in Manhattan or on a farm, whether you're 15 or 85. And if you, like me, have also internalized some twisted-up theology that this healing and restoration Jesus offers are not for you, that you're a server in this great restaurant, a crew member aboard this lovely ship, then you're destined to exhaust yourself, tugging on the bootstraps of your soul, lifting something that was never meant to be carried alone. On Jesus. As I arrive nearer and nearer to the heart of things, at least as close as I'm able to get right now, what lies at the center are these four things: Jesus, Aaron, gratitude, and strength. As I leave things behind, heavy things, things that have kept me trapped and exhausted for so long, the outer ring of this beautiful center is gratitude. I'm so thankful for what it is to be human and for this world and how gorgeous and odd and heartbreakingly lovely it is. I'm so thankful for blackberries and peonies and newborns and the smell of rosemary and the sound of singing, especially the wild, raspy, throaty kind. I'm so thankful for kisses from little boys and the hush of snowfall and the scent of lavender. I'm grateful for Paris and Jerusalem and San Francisco and for Three Lakes, Wisconsin, South Haven, Michigan, and the bonfire pit at my in-law's house where four generations of that special family have roasted marshmallows and invariably sung in perfect six-part harmony. I'm so thankful for Aaron, for our marriage, for the gentle, daily weaving together of stories and souls and bodies, for the life we've made together, the family. With each passing year, I'm more thankful. We're more than we were a year ago and a year before that. The temperature's dropping as the sun dips behind the clouds. I feel like I've sat on every bench in this entire camp, and at the same time, I feel like I never want to leave. Tomorrow I'll walk for coffee, maybe, early in the cool of the dewy morning. And then I'll find another bench, maybe an entirely new one, and my laptop and I will settle in for as long as it takes. I used to be afraid that I was hollow somehow, that I only existed if someone could see me and hear me like a toddler playing peekaboo. My whole life was an elaborate attempt at never having to be alone with myself. But the invitations kept coming, grace upon grace, to leave things behind, shed old skins, release long-held brokennesses. And when I finally walked away from all those things, there I was, alone with myself, and what I found astounded me. I wasn't afraid at all. More than that, instead of being afraid or hollow or nothing at all, what I found was strength. I found an unshakable core of love and passion and desire to make the world better. I found focus and a sense of power I'd never known. This is the great anomaly of it. We cling to these structures because we think they're what keep us safe, as if we're bugs who need exoskeletons, shells outside of ourselves to protect us. But when you start to understand how strong you are, you realize that you don't need a shell at all. The inside is strong and secure and doesn't need to be shielded by all those other things: performance, proving, busyness. There's nothing left to be shed, and at the center is strength, gratitude, Jesus. I'm practicing that last part, to be honest. For reasons I still don't totally understand, the idea that the person of Christ is sitting next to me, bodily, keeping me company, breathing in and out as I do, it's still tricky for me. And it's still tricky for me to hand him all my silly human concerns, little wounds and worries, dreams and discouragements. But I spend more and more time sitting with him, not with the platonic ideal of divinity, abstracted away to a safe distance. I sit with Jesus, the human and divine being sent to be with us, Emmanuel. I practice being with him. It feels as awkward as I'm making it sound, I'm sure. It feels sort of like if you told me a nice bunny rabbit was sitting next to me and it adored me, and all I had to do was tell it everything because the bunny is all powerful. I don't mean that in any disrespectful way, of course. I'm learning, minute by minute that I spend sitting with him, allowing myself to be heard, my heart held, my dreams known. We're in uncharted territory now, so I don't know exactly how things shift from here, but I'm finding that my ability to sit with Jesus makes me more present and connected with Aaron and with my boys. As I create space and imagination within myself to be heard by the actual person of Christ, my capacity to hear the people I love is increasing, and my sense of strength deep inside myself grows and grows. So much of life seems to be about reclaiming. Creativity, of course, is so easy and natural for children, and most adults struggle to recover that wild courage to make and imagine and play. And I'm learning that spiritual practice is a reclaiming too. I used to know how to do this kind of prayer when I was a child, when so many voices weren't yelling their bad advice at me while I prayed, telling me I was doing it wrong in 1,000 different directions. But here's the thing. I might be doing it wrong in someone else's view, but as I sit, my heart grows more compassionate. My gratitude increases. I become more humble, more thankful, less fearful. So maybe there isn't a wrong on this one, so long as it's yielding a Godward heart. And at the end of it all, at the center of it all, that's the whole of who I am, this Godward heart. Amen. Part 5. Living in time. The greatest tragedy of human existence is not to live in time, in both senses of the word. Christian Wiman, My Bright Abyss. Clearing away. Of all the things I'm learning to leave behind, one of the heaviest is the opinion of others. One of the peculiarities of being a writer is that your work is judged and measured publicly all the time. This many stars, this many books sold, reviews and criticisms, detailed speaker evaluations, there is no shortage of opinions. Writing is such good training for the rest of life, if you allow it to be, because it forces you to get comfortable with failure, with the wide range of impossible to meet expectations and standards. I hear all the time that I'm both too conservative and too liberal, too shallow and too deep, too casual and too formal. When our closest friends gather around our table, we do not all agree about theology or politics or education or almost anything at all, and that's just as it should be. Friendship isn't forged out of sameness, and anyone who has in-laws knows that family isn't either. If our dinner tables represent great diversity of thought and opinion, imagine how much more diverse our churches and neighborhoods are, let alone the Wild West of the internet. And some of what I'm leaving behind in this season is the need to please everyone. I want to respect all people. I want to learn from all people, most especially people who are different from me and who disagree with me. But pleasing, for me, is over. Pleasing is such a fraught and freighted word, it seems, saccharine and oversweet. Let's do so much more than simply please people. Let's see them and love them and delight them. Look deeply into their eyes. Pleasing is a shallow and temporary joy, not nearly as valuable or rich as seeing or connecting or listening. Pleasing feels like corn syrup, like cheap candy, while pleasure is homemade pie, rich with butter, thick with sugar and ripe fruit. For years, I've bridged that gap between differing opinions, tempered my own, made sure everyone in the room was happy and fed and taken care of. It began as a clean love for hospitality, but over the years, I think, it devolved into caretaking and people-pleasing at the expense of my own self, at the expense of telling the truth about what I think and what I need and what matters most to me. These days, I want to love deeply and well, and that's really different from pleasing. Love is often quieter, and it's never connected to that anxious proving and tap dancing that so many of us have learned to keep people happy. After a lifetime of believing that the voices that mattered were out there, approving or disapproving of me, I'm learning to trust the voice within, the voice of God's Spirit, the whisper of my own soul. And when you learn to listen to that voice, the screaming of the crowd matters less. In some blessed moments, it matters not at all. People, individual people, matter more to me than ever. I'm giving more focused time to the people I love than I ever have. Eye to eye, uninterrupted, deeply connected. But people, as in what people think, that nameless, faceless swamp of opinions, has less to say to me now than it ever has. And the freedom in that is astounding. Learning to play. One of my new things, of which there are many these days, I feel sort of adolescent, changing and growing and trying new things faster than I can keep up with, in a good way, is playing. Playing. Spending time lavishly, staring into space, wandering around the block, sitting on the kitchen floor eating blueberries with Mac. My goal upon returning to real life after lake life is to keep my summer heart, my flexible, silly, ready to play, ever so slightly irresponsible heart. What I've been delighted to find is that it's not that our real life is all wrong by any means. It's not that I'm doing work I hate or that I'm ill-fit for the life we've made. It's that for all sorts of reasons, I default to hustle mode all too often. Hustle is the opposite of heart. And so one of the tiny little things I'm learning to do is to play, essentially to purposely waste time. Strategically avoid strategy for 5 minutes at a time. Intentionally not be intentional about every second. Have no purpose on purpose. There are lots of conversations right now about how to do everything better, faster, smarter, how to streamline, multitask, layer, balance, flow, juggle, how to monetize, strategize, and on and on. This is good stuff, necessary stuff. But my jam these days is wasting time, playing, becoming aware of that internal engine that always wants to go faster, faster, faster. That engine is not the best part of me. My heart is the best part of me. And I'm finding that my heart loves to play. My heart loves to color and draw, loves to dance in the kitchen, loves to shoot baskets, loves to do cartwheels with my nieces in the front yard. What would our lives be like if our days were studded by tiny, completely unproductive, silly, non-strategic, wild and beautiful 5-minute breaks? Reminders that our days are for loving and learning and laughing, not for pushing and planning. Reminders that it's all about the heart, not the hustle. Morning and evening. I've always stayed up later than I should, wringing the last moments out of the day. Pouring the last glass of wine from the bottle, reading one more chapter, having just one more conversation. One year in my 20s, one of my New Year's resolutions was to stop sleeping in my clothes. I had a terrible habit of just falling into bed, jeans and all, and I was determined to stop that because it seemed highly adolescent. Several years later in my 30s, I made another New Year's resolution to start really taking care of my face, meaning stop using baby wipes and start using real cleanser and moisturizer like a grown-up lady. I do it sometimes, to be honest. And then last year, my friend Emily and Ariana Huffington taught me to wear proper pajamas, and I consider it a breakthrough of sorts. Emily and I went to England together, the first few nights near Windsor for a speaking event for me, and then a night in London at the Dean Street Townhouse, which we both agreed was one of the loveliest hotels ever. In the middle of the first day, after flying all night, going straight into meetings, then having a break to nap before speaking that night, we went back to the hotel. I put on leggings, the same ones I'd wear if we went for a walk, and a t-shirt, the same ones I'd wear if we went for a walk. Emily put on crisp, striped cotton pajamas, a matching top and bottom, and I coveted them. I had just read Ariana Huffington's fantastic book, Thrive, and she makes a point that we should all wear pajamas, and that the epidemic of wearing workout clothes to bed, especially women, has to end. Our bodies listen to what we put on them, she says. So when it's time to rest, tell your body it's time to rest by putting on your pajamas, clothes specifically made for private spaces, for quiet, for sleep. Don't confuse your body by dressing it the same way you would to go to the gym or to coffee. After we returned from London, I bought my first real pair of pajamas in years, navy cotton with red piping like an old man, an old English man, maybe. I adored them. I've got polka-dotted flannel ones now for winter and a light blue set with my monogram on the pocket. I have absolutely fully converted to pajamas because after a lifetime of sleeping first in jeans and a face full of makeup and then yoga pants and a hoodie, I'm finally learning to rest my body and mind in loving, peaceful ways. I'm learning that it matters. I used to put pajamas and night cream in the same fussy, fancy category as, you know, self-care. But all my force and pushing brought me to the end of myself quite dramatically, brought me to poor health, isolation, exhaustion, resentment. So here I am. Self-care, pajamas, night cream, all of it. I'm also learning to leave sort of a sacred margin at the beginning and end of the day, to go to bed earlier and wake up earlier, letting the transitions between sleeping and waking and the reverse be a little gentler. Like so many things, I'm bringing the lake way of living into the rest of the year. At home, I never think to begin and end my days outside, but at the lake, it seems so natural to walk straight out onto the porch with my coffee in hand, and also so fitting to end the day there. Watching the blue sky fade to pink, watching the last beachgoers straggle back to their cars, pulling wagons and pushing strollers, wet towels around their necks, feet sandy and hair messy, it feels fitting to spend the opening and closing margins of the day on the porch, which is essentially the perfect in-between space, not inside, not fully outside, not privately tucked inside the home, but not on a city street entirely public. When I begin the day in quiet on the porch, it connects me to God through prayer, and it connects me to God through His creation. There's something wonderful and healthy and healing about being outside, something my own life is crying out for. Being outside reminds me of life and God and growth and the energy and motion of nature, all things I forget so easily when I spend too much life indoors, too much in the world of laptops and laundry and lists. I don't rush outside every single morning tearing down the driveway in our decidedly suburban neighborhood, but more often than not in the first few moments out of bed, at the very least, I open the front door and I breathe in the fresh air. For many months of the year, it's achingly cold, and I slam the door almost immediately, cursing and shivering, but I love the reminder that there's a whole wild world out there, animals and trees and moon. I try to breathe a few deep breaths of that bitter cold air, hopping from foot to foot, wind cutting through my flannel pajamas. I think about God and creation and all the wild and wonderful things that he's made, that he's making. I feel small and I feel a part of it all, and I feel thankful more than ever for another day. Simplicity. One thing I love about both the Catholic and Jewish traditions is how connected both are to real, touchable, material life. Evangelical Protestant Christianity so often severs the connection between sacred and material, but I believe that's both an artificial and an unhelpful dichotomy. What we own, what we touch, what we carry, these things matter. What we surround ourselves with, how we regard our material possessions and our physical selves, these things matter. I've always known this, but I'm learning it in all new depths this season. As I've been aching for simplicity inside myself, in my heart, in my spirit, I've been surprised to find how much simplifying my material world has created space not just around me, but inside me. In preparation for a long international trip recently, I packed pink and red and blue shirts, jeans, leggings, boots, and even though I dragged a rainbow of clothes halfway across the world, every morning, all I wanted to wear was white, black, gray, and blue. The same is generally true at home. I always feel most comfortable in neutrals and blues, and my friends tease me about how often I wear stripes, navy and white, black and white, over and over. I think my preference for only neutrals and blues struck me more forcefully on this trip for two reasons. First, because I kept having to pack and repack all these brightly colored things I wasn't even wearing. And second, because I was trying so hard to find simplicity in so many areas of life, and this one was sort of staring me in the face, waiting for me to catch on. When I got home from the trip, I returned the pink and red and green shirts I'd carried thousands of miles, having never even removed the tags. I cleaned out my closet, selling and donating bags and bags of things. Colors I didn't wear, even though I thought I should. Shapes that someone would love, but I didn't. And when I was finished, I felt lighter, more like myself. For some people, getting dressed is a delight, a way to tell the world who they are, a creative and inspiring process. Some people get a little charge of energy from the pure variety of what they buy and put together and wear. I'm finding that I get a little charge of energy from knowing exactly what I love and what I don't, and being clear about the two. I'm more inspired by a near uniform, a narrow set of parameters that make me feel most like myself. I love wearing black, white, gray, and blue. And I love classic shapes, stripes, jeans. I love the flash of metallics, like gold sandals and jewelry. I find such delight and energy in this newly simple way of dressing that actually I'd been practicing for a long time, only now my closet reflected it. I've been doing the same thing in my kitchen for several years, and the simplicity and focus brings me great joy. When we moved from Grand Rapids back to Chicago, I brought dishes upon dishes. I was never a crazy clothes shopper or even a wild accumulator of home stuff, but dishes were my absolute downfall. I had sets upon sets, half sets, specialized sets, four bowls and a serving bowl for pasta, dozens of tiny dessert plates, a truly insane amount of champagne flutes I'd accumulated over the years, mismatched and colorful. My dear cousin persuaded me to part with everything that wasn't white, glass, silver, or wood, with the exception of my red Le Creuset cookware, the kitchen equivalent of my love for blue clothing. We boxed up green and purple dishes, hand-painted harlequin print servingware, a whole set of lavender enameled tin plates and bowls, and kept only white plates, clear juice glasses, and white serving platters. My cousin promised that the simplicity of it would bring me joy, and it absolutely did. Our kitchen since then has been filled with only the things we use and love, things that all go together, things that are easily and cheaply replaced if they break. In the kitchen, in the closet, and throughout the rest of the house, I kept finding that the more I let go of, the happier I was. It almost seemed like the less stuff there was in our house, the more freely I could breathe, the more deeply I was able to think. It makes sense to me because, as in so many other areas, I've always loved the way we interact with our stuff at the lake. It's easier, of course, to live with simplicity in a house that's not yours for a couple weeks at a time. But I do find when I'm there, I don't miss all our stuff. I like having just a few dresses, flip-flops, shorts. I like a bin or two of toys, one stack of books. I like having one candle that I bring from home, two boxes of tea, Aaron's guitar and Henry's colored pencils, and little else cluttering up the house. Of course, it's easy to live simple just for a short season in a home that's not yours. But every August when we return home, I'm amazed by all our stuff. And invariably, as we unpack, I also pack up boxes and boxes of things that lake life has taught me are inessential. And I breathe more deeply as I do. My love for dishes is only rivaled by my love for books. And for a while in our home, we had them in every room, including the guest bathroom, and even stacked in every inch of a non-working fireplace. Stacks of books as end tables, on the back of the toilet, in the kids' rooms, a couple on every step leading down to the basement. But lightness. But simplicity. And so one sunny morning, Mac and I took more than 20 boxes to a used bookstore. I kept only books that I would reread or recommend wholeheartedly to a friend, and that still left a lot. But 20 boxes out the door did indeed make a big difference. The other benefit I'm finding in these newer, narrower parameters about what I wear and what fills my cabinets is that I'm finding I make better decisions when I make fewer decisions. When I open my closet and see only things I love and relatively few of them. When I open my cabinets and see nothing but white plates, those are just that many fewer decisions to make in a day that always, invariably, make that day just a couple ticks easier. And I'll take it. I'm able to give more focused attention on the higher stakes decisions in my life, the ones about parenting, marriage, friendship, when I don't have to think hard about what to wear or how to manage all my stuff. The ambient noise of my life gets quieter when there's less stuff in my life and fewer decisions to make about that stuff. And in the newfound silence is space for connection, rest, listening, learning. I find myself filling my cart and my shopping bag differently these days too. Do I want to manage this, clean this, find a place for this? Will this bring me ongoing joy, or will it be just another thing to store, just another thing to clutter up my mind and home? I'm bringing fewer and fewer things into our home, and I'm shopping for other people in new ways too. What are timeless, useful gifts instead of easy-to-pick-up knickknacks? Or even better, what experiences can we share instead of what items can I fill their home with? These days, Erin and I go for walks, meals, trips. We used to buy each other jewelry or golf clubs, respectively. Now we buy games to play with the kids, tickets to shows, trips to cities we love, and our marriage is the richer for it. It's been said a million times that the most important things aren't things. But if we're not careful, it seems, many of us find ourselves overwhelmed by all the stuff we have to manage instead of focused on what we're most passionate about, writing or making or painting or connecting with people. I want the stuff in my life to be light, easily managed, simple, so that the best of my energy is free for people, dreams, creativity, so that we can make memories around the table, eating meals served on those white plates, so that I can run after my kids in one of a half dozen striped shirts, so that when you want to borrow a book, each one on my shelf tells a meaningful story. How we live matters, and what you choose to own will shape your life whether you choose to admit it or not. Let's live lightly. Freely, courageously, surrounded only by what brings joy, simplicity, and beauty. Happy medium. What it seems the world wants me to be. Really skinny and really tired. If I could shrink and hustle, I'd be right there. Skinny and tired. Shrink and hustle. This is what our culture wants women to be. Skinny and tired from relentlessly shrinking and hustling. To be clear, I have nothing against people who are really skinny, whether that's just how God made their bodies or because fitness and nutrition are a central part of their lives. You do you, skinny people. But I'm going to do me, and me is not skinny. I'm just not. I've lived all my life, nearly 40 years, believing a fantasy that I'm just about 6 months from finally being skinny. Okay, 6 months. Okay, six more. Oops, I don't know what I was doing the last 6 months, but 6 months from now, for sure. You know what? 6 months from now, I bet I'm going to look pretty much like this. How do I know? Because I've basically been this size since I was 14 years old. I think my body's trying to tell me something, and essentially it's this, hey, crazy lady, this is what God gave you, and you're sort of the last to know. And so at long last, I'm making peace with medium and choosing to be happy, rested, not exhausted, not afraid, not wired and panicky all the time. This is countercultural. This is rebellious. What I want so deeply and what I want to offer you, grace and nourishment, And those are the exact opposites of what I've been practicing for so long, exhaustion and starvation. This is hospitality at its core. This is the beat of my heart to experience grace and nourishment and to offer it one in each hand to every person I meet. Grace and nourishment. You can rest. You don't have to starve. The messages of the world say in no uncertain terms, ruin yourself, starve yourself, wring yourself out. Ignore your hunger, your soul, your sickness, your longing. Exhaustion and starvation are the twin virtues of that world, but I will not live there anymore. I will practice hospitality, the offering of grace and nourishment to myself. Instead of being starved and small, I will be medium, and I will be happy. Or actually, maybe not. Maybe I won't be happy all the time. Maybe when I'm 60 instead of 40, I'll be able to be happy with my size, with my flesh. But of course, this is exactly the point. Hospitality, not perfection. I'll show hospitality even to the fact that I'm sometimes unhappy with my body. Unhappiness, come right in, sit right down. We'll sit together. You'll stay until you tire of this and go. I will practice hospitality to my very own body. You can rest. You can be nourished. You can be loved. I'll also practice hospitality to my complicated feelings about my body because they're a part of me too. Some of my obsession with perfection rears its head on this topic. I don't often these days expect my body to be perfect, but I do sometimes demand that my outlook about it to be perfectly evolved and positive. I'm not there yet. I'm going to both take up and create space for my body and also for my sadness and my longing and my anger. There's room here for good days and bad ones, for crying in dressing rooms and dancing in the kitchen, for sizing up my jeans again, and for feeling something like beautiful when my husband captures a photo of me on the beach with our boys. I really wanted to have this part of my life nailed by the time I turned 40. I suppose I still could. We have a couple months. But I think this is one I might not ever nail. It might be one I just learn to make space for in my life and my heart. Here's to being medium. And here's to sometimes being happy about it and to giving myself space and grace when I'm not. On snow. God's voice thunders in marvelous ways. He does great things beyond our understanding. He says to the snow, "Fall on the earth." Enter the rain shower, be a mighty downpour. Job 37, 5 and 6. I love the freedom and grace that flood through me when I read this passage from Job. God says to the snow, fall on the earth. That's it. Just do one thing. Just fall. And then he says to the rain shower, be a mighty downpour. Essentially, he's saying, just do the thing I've actually created you to do. You're rain, so rain. You're snow. So snow. I love the simplicity of that, the tremendous weight that takes off my shoulders. God's asking me to be the thing he's already created me to be. And he's asking you to be the thing he's already created for you to be. He doesn't tell the snow to thaw and become rain or the rain to freeze itself into snow. He says essentially, do your thing. Do the thing you love to do that you've been created to do. So many of us twist ourselves up in knots, trying desperately to be something else, someone else, some endless list of qualities and capabilities we think will make us loved or safe or happy. It's an exhausting way to live, and I know that because I've done it. God tells the rain to just pour down. He tells the snow to simply fall. What are the things that he's asking you to do, the things he made you to do, the things you do effortlessly and easily? What do you do with the ease and lightness of falling snow? Many of us have wandered so far from these things. We've gotten wrapped up in what someone else wanted us to be, what we thought would keep us happy and safe and gain us approval. But there's tremendous value in traveling back to our essential selves, the loves and skills and passions that God planted inside us long ago. When I look at my life these days, I see the threads of passion and identity that I've carried throughout my whole life. Books and reading, people and connection, food and the table. These are the things I've always loved, and they continue to bring me great joy and fulfillment. Think about your adolescent self, your child self, the you you've always been. God imprinted a sacred, beautiful collection of passions and capacities right onto your heart. What do you love? What does your passion bubble over for? So much of adulthood is peeling off the layers of expectation and pressure and protecting those precious things that lie beneath. We live in a culture that shouts, that prescribes rather narrowly what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a success, what it means to live a valuable life. But those definitions require us to live on a treadmill, both literally and figuratively, always hustling to fit in, to be thin enough and young enough and sparkly enough, for our homes to be large and spotless, our children well-mannered and clean-faced, our dreams orderly and profitable. But that's not life. That's not where the fullness of joy and meaning are found. The snow is only meant, created, commanded to fall. The rain is only meant, created, commanded to pour down. You were only meant, created, commanded to be who you are, weird and wonderful, imperfect and messy and lovely. What do you need to leave behind in order to recover that essential self that God created? What do you need to walk away from in order to reclaim those parts of you that God designed, unique to you and for His purposes? Part 6, Throwing Candy. When we are who we are called to be, we will set the world ablaze. St. Catherine of Siena. Throwing Candy. I had an experience a couple summers ago that changed everything for me. That sounds hyperbolic, I know. But every once in a while, we have these experiences that slice our lives into before and after, and this was one of those for me. A friend of a friend invited me on a trip to a place I'd never been, with a group of people, most of whom I'd never met. I didn't know what to expect, but I did have this sense that there was something waiting for me there, something I needed to learn, a conversation, a lesson, a moment. There was lots of space and silence. The stars were so bright, and layers of stress and regret and toughness I'd been wearing for ages slipped off one by one until there I was, just me. And without that shell, it's like I could feel everything and see everything with such clarity. It was like technicolor. And I knew that there was something important there for me to see. I could sense it. For the first time in a long time, I was really paying attention. One of the traditions of this place is that when you see kayakers in the water paddling by from the nearby camp, no matter what you're doing, you stop and throw candy to them. Because it's fun. Because it's a sweet tradition. Because it makes people happy. If you knew me 10 years ago, you'd say, that type of thing is so Shauna. She's totally the candy-throwing type. But to be honest, I don't know if you'd say that about me the last couple years. One afternoon, the kayakers crossed in front of our dock while about a million other things were happening. Two large powerboats were docking, as well as a sailboat, and a few paddleboarders were trying not to get in the way. There were swimmers in the water, all at the same time, in a relatively small space. But the man who was in charge of it all, our host, the one who was responsible for everything, who owned all the stuff that was about to crash in about 1,000 ways, stopped what he was doing and sprinted down the dock to get the lollipops. I had a little panic attack because what he was doing seemed so irresponsible. Warning word, irresponsible. He threw candy right in the middle of it. Everything swirled around him, and he kept throwing candy over and over, handful after handful. And everything was fine. All the boats were docked safely. The swimmers were fine. Nothing happened. As I watched from the deck of the lodge, I put my head down on the wide railing, and I began to sob. Because I used to throw candy right in the middle of it all. I used to throw candy no matter what. I used to be warm and whimsical. I used to believe in the power of silliness and memory-making and laughter. And then I became the kind of person who threw candy as long as nothing else was going on, as long as it didn't get in the way of being responsible. I threw candy at approved and sanctioned candy-throwing time after all the work was done and things were safe and lunches were made. And then I got so wrapped up in being responsible that it was never the right time to throw candy. And then, the worst thing, I became the kind of person who made fun of candy throwers. Please, who has time? What is this, kindergarten? I've got a list, people, and a flight to catch. What a loss for me, for my family, for our community, for all the joy and laughter and silliness we missed out on because I was busy being busy. These are the hardest changes I've made in a long time, and they're the most valuable. I'm never going back there. I'm done with that kind of responsible. I don't want to get to the end of my life and look back and realize that the best thing about me was I was organized, that I executed well, that I ran a tight ship, that I never missed a detail. I want to look back and remember all the times I threw candy, even when it didn't make sense, especially when it didn't make sense. I know how hard it is to juggle everything. I'm right in it, with little kids and a full-time job and dreams for the future and regrets about the past. And that's why I'm throwing candy every chance I get. Essential self. You find peace not by rearranging the circumstances of your life, but by realizing who you are at the deepest level. Thomas Merton. I drove up to Lake Geneva for a few days, needing the silence and sounds and smells of the lake to get some writing done. I slept the way you only sleep at camp, hard and deep, never moving an inch. And I started the day talking to my boys, Mac's sweet voice on the phone sounding a million miles away instead of an hour. I drove into town for coffee and a croissant, and now I'm back to camp, in an Adirondack chair overlooking the peninsula. A group is gathered at the fire pit down the hill, and I can't make out the words, but I hear the lilts and rises of a woman's voice from time to time. The clouds are low but not dark, and the green is impossibly vivid everywhere you look. If this journey has been the peeling of an onion layer by layer, or the unnesting of Russian dolls shedding external selves like skin, it seems we are reaching the center. The center is reached once again through silence, time, honesty, loss. By leaving behind all the voices and expectations, all the selves and costumes of other times, things that worked then, but don't work any longer. This is, I realize, middle age. But here's the thing. Every new season of life is an invitation to leave behind the things of the season before. The trappings and traps that have long expired, right for then, no longer right for now. Whatever passage you're facing, entering your 20s or your 60s, facing life alone for the first time in a long time, or learning the new dance of partnership, becoming a parent or becoming an empty nester, leaving student life behind or becoming a student once again, has the potential to be your sea change, your invitation to leave behind what's not essential and travel deeply into the heart of things. This is a pattern we can recreate all our lives over and over. Because who's ever totally finished leaving things behind? One new thing that began to emerge as I stopped ignoring my exhaustion and burying some of the brokennesses in my relationships, I started to have opinions. I mean, opinions. I've always had opinions, certainly, but I've always been surrounded by people with strong opinions too, and I've learned a very complicated geometry about which things I'm allowed to feel strongly about. There were so many things I left to other people to feel strongly about. So much so that I often bent under the weight of so many other people's strongly held opinions, tired from having to bridge all the gaps around me. Truth-telling, though, is both contagious and addictive, and once you start doing it, it's hard to stop. All of a sudden, opinions fell out of my mouth left and right. I knew so well, so deeply, that the areas in which my life went off course were the same areas in which I had abdicated responsibility and voice. I did what people thought would be good for me. I did what should have been done. I became what I was expected to become, and it did not get me where I wanted to be. And so I'm learning to trust my feelings and my strong opinions, believing that they will be better guides than the nameless, faceless they I allowed to guide me for so long. Many years ago, at breakfast with a mentor, I articulated as best I could at the time my greatest dream for my life. She was a great question asker, and she kept pushing me for greater and greater specificity. And then what? What would that look like? Exactly how? This is what I told her. I want to marry someone who feels like a partner, a true peer. I want to have little boys and live in a house with a blue room where I write. And when I look out the window in the backyard, my boys will be playing soccer. When I'm done writing, I'll go down to the kitchen to stir something on the stove. A huge pot of red sauce, maybe, for the people who will gather around our table later. And while I stir, I'll talk on the phone with one of the pastors at our church. I wouldn't be working there, but I'd help in some way. I told her I wanted to write and be married and be a mom of boys and gather people in our home and help our church. Those are the things I wanted more than anything in the world. I didn't move forward on this plan at all. I kept working at our church and then another in an obsessive, workaholic way, letting work shadow over absolutely everything. Then I did become a writer. But the writing life quickly became the traveling and speaking life almost accidentally, the obvious next step to everyone but me. On paper, it looked like I was living that very dream from that conversation all those years ago. Unless the paper was my travel schedule. I wasn't standing at my stove very often or hosting people around our table. I wasn't in town long enough to make a meaningful contribution at my church. I wasn't even a writer very often. I was grinding out a grueling travel schedule that I didn't enjoy but didn't know how to dismantle. Everyone was so happy about it, about each new opportunity. I didn't know till much later how profoundly unhappy I was about it. I longed to be back in that blue room, back at the stove, back on the lawn playing soccer with my boys. And somewhere along the line, I developed the theology that said if it's working, it must be God's will, and if